when you're dealing with complex problems, which this is a perfect example of, it's impossible to simply come up with the answer in a boardroom. You're always going to be wrong. What you need to do is have an attitude of probing, testing, and learning. Let's try this. Let's see how that works. Okay, that worked, so we can continue to do that. But that didn't work, so we need to adjust course. And that is increasingly the way that you have to find your way forward in the world. It doesn't take a lot of time. It's not about not acting. You're acting constantly, but you're acting knowing that you may have to modify your actions.
Welcome to the Your Living Brand.life show. This show is all about how you communicate your value, how you build influence through trust, and recognizing who your audience is and who they are not. Through our weekly conversations with our guests, we will explore different ways to enable you to demonstrate your uniqueness while we ask them, what's your story? And now, welcome our host, Ben Baker.
Welcome to another episode of the Your Living Brand.live show. Welcome back, my wonderful audience. It's Ben calling you. Thank you guys every week. You comment, you listen, you share. You know, I could not do this show without you. So thank you for all your support week in and week out. I have a question for you. What if all the information you had, all the data that you had, all the insights that you had were wrong? The conceptions that you had, the thoughts that you had, the ideas that you came out of them were wrong. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We got Bryce Hoffman joining us, and we're going to talk about red team thinking. And I'm going to let him explain to what this is, because you know what? This is something that every organization needs to be thinking about. Bryce, welcome to the show.
Ben, it is a pleasure to be here.
I am honored. I heard you on a podcast, I'm trying to think, maybe 4 or 5 months ago. And I heard you talking about this red team thinking, and I went, this is brilliant. This is something that it's intuitive because it's counterintuitive, and it makes so much sense. And I'm sitting there going, okay, I've got to find out, how do I get in touch with Bryce? How do I get him on my show? Because I think this is a concept that really needs a great light shone on it. So
it does.
Let's sit down and let's talk about red team thinking. Give some people an idea of who you are, what you do, and let's get into the red team thinking.
Absolutely, Ben. So who I am is, I'm a best-selling author, a top-rated leadership speaker, and I am the founder and president of Red Team Thinking. And what red team thinking is a cognitive capability that engages critical thinking, enables distributed decision-making, and encourages diversity of thought. It's both a mindset and a set of tools, and those tools allow you to stress test your strategies, to challenge your assumptions, to identify unseen threats and missed opportunities, to make decisions faster, better decisions faster, and through all of these things, to better navigate this crazy complex world we live in today.
It's critical because we all walk into scenarios, whether it's board meetings, whether it's the baseball team, whatever it is, with preconceived notions of what's right, what's wrong. This is what the data tells us.
Yes.
And the question is that really what the data tells us?
Or are we even looking at the data? So what you see is that, Ben, for about 3 centuries, people thought that we humans made fundamentally rational decisions. This was first codified, first articulated by Adam Smith, and he called it the rational choice theory. And this theory dominated economics, psychology, any arena that was interested in figuring out how we make decisions. And what Adam Smith said was that we make the best decisions possible based on the information, based on the data that we have, unless we're swayed by strong emotions like love or anger or an unhealthy obsession with tulips or NFTs or something like that. And the problem, though, Ben, is that Adam Smith was completely wrong. And over the past 4 decades, a small army of cognitive psychologists and other scientists in thousands and thousands of experiments have proven that that's not how we make decisions. That's how we wish we made decisions. That in fact, the way we make decisions is by relying on one of two modes of thought. They call them system one thinking and system two thinking. And for people who are interested in diving deeper into this, the best person to read on this is Dr. Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize for his work in this arena. He wrote the book Thinking Fast and Slow and others. But to give the synopsis of what it is, system one thinking is automatic and intuitive. We don't even have to, it just happens. So if I come at you with a flamethrower, you don't spend a lot of time, Ben, thinking, I wonder what's going to happen if that flame touches me. Is it going to be a good thing? Is it going to be a bad thing? And do I like fire? Do I not like fire? No, you just intuitively know to run away from this crazy guy with a flamethrower. That's system one.
That's thinking. Instinct.
Exactly.
In a base way of looking at it.
Absolutely. System two thinking is what Kahneman calls deliberate and effortful. So we actually have to sit and say, so if I write even a simple algebraic equation on a chalkboard, unless you're a math savant, you've got to engage system two thinking to solve it. You've got to go, what is X and how do I solve for X? Oh, I remember from 10th grade how to solve for X. Okay, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to solve for X. And no, I know what X is now. That's system two thinking. So here's the problem that Kahneman and others have uncovered is most of the time when we think we're using system two thinking, because our brains are fundamentally lazy, we default to using system one thinking and think we're using system two thinking. So we're relying on past experience, we're relying on prejudices, we're relying on cognitive biases that all of us, no matter how smart we are, no matter how well educated, no matter how successful we are, fall victim to all the time because it's the way our brains are wired. And so because we're not aware of that happening, we get results of our decision-making that are less than optimal because we think we're thinking things through when really these things are just bouncing around in our heads and kind of skewing our decisions off of the course we think we're heading on.
That's fascinating. I mean, I have this
distinct, and frightening.
Oh, it is. It's very frightening. I have this distinct memory of taking a statistics course in university.
Right.
And I had a stats professor who swore stats don't lie. The data is the data. Mm-hmm. You're going to get one statistics out of this and stats don't lie. So I wrote a paper and I proved a theorem based on a set of statistics all the way up to the middle of the paper. Mm-hmm. And then I said, however, and I disproved that same theorem using the exact same set of statistics. I had to go up to the dean of the department to get my paper, you know, regraded because this guy was just furious at me.
Right.
Because his thought is that data is data and data, all rational decisions need to be made of data and that everybody is going to come to the same conclusions given the same information in front of them. And what I'm hearing from you is that's the furthest thing from the truth.
Well, not exactly. I mean, data is data. The question is it the right data? That's the thing.
Right.
So if you're measuring the wrong thing, your measurements can be perfectly accurate. They can be objectively true, but you can still draw the wrong conclusions because you're not measuring the right things. So take an example of, I don't know how many of your listeners live in the southern United States have ever experienced the joy of kudzu.
So explain kudzu
for those who haven't experienced. Kudzu is an invasive weed native to the Korean Peninsula that grows in the U.S. at an insane rate. So that if a house in a kudzu area is left unattended for a year and you come back, the house will be buried under kudzu. If you're in an area like that and come back 6 months later without moving, kudzu will be growing all over your car. So where did this monster weed come from? Well, it came from assessing the data. Back in the 1930s, I believe it was, when the Dust Bowl was happening, the U.S. Department of Agriculture wanted to, and there was also a problem with erosion because of flooding in that part of the country, they studied to find what is a fast-growing plant with a deep root system that could anchor the soil and keep it from washing away in floods and blowing away in dust storms. And they did a lot of research. And they said, we have found the perfect plant. It's called kudzu, and it comes from Korea. And the solution is simple. We will plant it along riverbanks and fields all over the southern United States. So the data wasn't wrong. Kudzu is a fast-growing plant with a deep root system that fixes the soil in the way that they were hoping. But they didn't look at it three-dimensionally. They didn't look at what would be the unintended consequences of planting all this kudzu. And now it's something that costs hundreds of millions of dollars a year on eradication efforts, on ruined farmland, on damage to buildings and stuff like this, all because they didn't think about the other consequences of planting this. And the world's filled with stories like that. The old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, is not far off.
So let's get back to the red team thinking in terms of its origin.
Sure.
At least from where you were talking about it, how it relates to 9/11. I'd love to hear that. How did red team thinking come out of 9/11? And how have you taken that from its original thing to where it is today? So I think that would be a good conversation.
Absolutely, Ben. So this concept of formal decision support red teaming, as you mentioned, was born out of 9/11 and out of two things that happened as a result of 9/11. So most people are probably aware now that in the wake of 9/11, there was a congressional committee and panel to figure out how did this happen? Because there were very quickly reports that, hey, you know, the FBI was investigating these guys, that there were all these tips to the CIA. Why did this happen when we knew had all this intelligence? And the conclusion of that investigation, the conclusion of those hearings, was that the U.S. intelligence establishment had suffered what they called a colossal failure of imagination. Think about that, failure of imagination. So they had access, again, to all this data. The data was correct, but they didn't piece it together in the right way. They didn't connect the dots until the terrorists connected them for them. So two things happened, as I said. One is, and this one actually happened before the report was even done. This happened on just after midnight on September 12th, 2001, while they were still pulling people from the ruins of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Then director of the CIA, George Tenet, stood up a group within the CIA called the Red Cell. He said, look, he said, we screwed up. We should have seen this coming. We had people in this building who were trying to ring the alarm bell, and we didn't listen to them. So he said, we're going to create this team, and the job of this team is going to be to take whatever the prevailing wisdom of the CIA is, to whatever the conclusions the CIA draws, and to try to argue that they're wrong, to try to challenge those conclusions, to poke holes in them, to help us see what we're missing. So the Red Cell got to work, and very quickly it began. You can go to the CIA's website. They say this openly. The Red Cell has been credited with preventing at least half a dozen major terrorist attacks against the United States since 9/11 that would have been equal to or significantly larger than the 9/11 attacks. And so that's the Red Cell, and it continues to operate today. And to facilitate that, the CIA developed an array of applied critical thinking and groupthink mitigation tools and techniques, many of which we borrowed and modified and evolved that formed the basis of the Red Team Thinking Toolkit. The second thing that happened as a result of 9/11, as we all know, Ben, is we invaded Iraq and Afghanistan. And initially, things seemed to be going really well from the point of view of the U.S. military. And then suddenly they weren't. And so by 2004, when the wheels started to come off in Iraq, and what had seemed to have been a fairly easily won victory was beginning to look like something quite different, an endless quagmire insurgency. The U.S. Army brought in a new general to lead the army, brought out of retirement, great general, General Peter Schumacher, and said, look, you've got two jobs. You got to try to figure out how to deal with the crisis that we're now in. And your second job is to figure out how we don't end up in this mess in the future, how we don't make the same mistakes again. So one of the things that Peter Schumacher did was to impanel a lessons learned team at the Pentagon to bring in people to say, what did we do wrong in the planning, in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq? And what can we do to make sure that doesn't happen in the future? And one of the key recommendations that came out of this was that, hey, here's what we didn't do. We didn't challenge our assumptions. We made a lot of very poor assumptions. Two, we didn't think about things from the perspective of other key stakeholders, like, say, the Iraqi people. We didn't include them in our discussions to figure out how things that we were planning on doing were going to look to them. And We made a lot of bad decisions based on our biases of previous conflicts that proved to be untrue. So they decided the way to combat that was to create a methodology, which they called red teaming, to deliberately challenge the plans, the strategies, the thinking of the Army in the future. And they set up a school at the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth to teach military officers, to teach a cadre of military officers, how to use these tools and techniques that the CIA and others had developed to do that, to stress test strategies, to challenge the organization's thinking, to play the devil's advocate, and to bring a contrarian approach to the military's thinking. And in 2015, I became the first and only civilian from outside government to talk my way into that school and to go through the U.S. Army's Red Team Leader course and graduate as a certified Red Team, Army Red Team thinker.
That must have been an amazing story unto itself, to figuring out how to get into a military college program as a civilian, let alone that one.
I called up the Pentagon and I said, I understand you have this amazing course. I think business could benefit from it tremendously. And I'd like to audit the course. And they said, who the hell do you think you are? And I said, I'm a best-selling author, a best-selling business author, and a really nice guy. And they said, again, who the hell do you think you are? Well, who I am, Ben, is incredibly persistent. And so I kept knocking on doors for about 6 months until, as one of the school's leaders said, they finally found the right lawyer to give the right fatwa to allow me to attend the course.
Nice.
And then I moved for a few months to a beautiful Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, garden spot of the lower Midwest.
It is a pretty picturesque type of city, isn't it?
In its own way.
In its own way. In its own way. Those who have not been there, it's not on the top 10 tourist destinations. Let's put it that way.
Unless you really like fast food and check cashing places.
Yes. They've got a lot of those.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. Do you want to be your best customer's vendor of choice? Do you want to cement relationships with them, add real value, and gain insights that your competitors just can't get? Go to podcasthostforhire.com. That's podcasthostforhire.com. And let's work together to make you the value vendor of choice. So it's interesting when you take a look at that and the thought process that goes with it. The one thing that I was thinking about is, in order to have a red team, you need to have the best and the brightest.
Yes.
You need to have people that are unafraid to A, voice their own opinion.
Yes.
Are willing to challenge convention.
Yes.
And are willing to take assumptions and sit there and say, what if I'm wrong? What if you're wrong? And that takes a very special type of person.
It does. And the way that the Army and the CIA and others, and this spread worldwide, by the way, very quickly to the British, to the Canadians, Australians, NATO, everyone, this formal red team process that they created requires a cadre of people like you described, and it requires a team. And that's initially when I wrote my book, Red Teaming, in 2015, that's what I attempt to do, is to port that model to business and to say, here's the model that is proven, that's battle tested, that works, and you should adopt this too. And then companies started calling me and asking me, can you help us implement this, bring the red teaming to our companies? But what I found, Ben, as I did that, is that as powerful as this approach is, it also created its own challenges. Because if you need to have the best and the brightest, you can't take the best and the brightest who are your best performing executives and say, you know what, you're no longer in charge of whatever you're in charge of. You're going to be on the red team now, and you're going to sit in an ivory tower, and you're going to wait for us to develop plans, and then you're going to analyze with your fellow red teamers those plans and strategies, and we're going to wait to hear what you have to say before we make a decision. That doesn't work in the real world because A, it creates logistical problems and organizational problems in terms of getting those personnel and the opportunity costs that are lost of them by them not doing their regular jobs. It can slow down the decision-making process, and it can even become a political football in terms of who owns the red team, who does it report to. So we evolved this formal process of red teaming to what we call red team thinking. And it relies on the same tools and techniques and the same basic approach, but we've modified it considerably so that instead of having to have this team, you can train your decision makers how to use these tools and techniques themselves so that it becomes part of their decision-making practice. You don't need a separate team. You don't need the separate step of red teaming the plan. If you have a major and important plan that really has high stakes, then you can bring some of those people together as an ad hoc team and do a more formal analysis. But they also, by having these tools and techniques, will improve the quality of decisions that they're making every single day. And the more that happens, the other thing that you get out of that is it changes the culture of the organization as well. And you start to develop a learning, a agile with a lowercase a, an adaptive learning, evolving culture that is continually challenging itself, continually improving on what it does, is never satisfied with where it's at, but is always figuring out ways to do what it's doing better. And when you get a culture like that, then you are going to stay ahead of your competition because no one's going to come and blow past you because you're fat, dumb, and happy with where you're at right now, which too many organizations are.
Well, the one thing that I'm thinking about when I hear you say that is it gets rid of groupthink.
Absolutely.
It gets people out of the mind that says, well, we've always thought this way, or we've always acted this way, or we've always hired this type of person, or we've always employed this type of vendor or whatever.
Yep. That's the way we've always done it around here.
Which is extremely dangerous. And whether it's an organization of five or with an organization of 50,000, to sit there and say what worked in 2019 is obviously going to work in 2022.
Well, look at how many organizations are struggling right now, Ben, with this return to work. And too many of them, that's what they do. They say, well, this is easy peasy. We just send an email, everyone's back to the office and things are just like they were back in 2019. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly they find, wait, where is everybody? No one's here. Look what happened at I think it was Goldman Sachs had like a rebellion.
They did.
Yeah. Goldman Sachs had a rebellion the first day back to work because they just sent out an email and told everyone, be at your desks at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, whatever it was. And then the senior leaders started walking around the headquarters in New York and say, where the heck is everybody? Mm-hmm. People didn't show up.
Yeah.
The world has changed. And so more thoughtful companies, more contrarian companies, deeper thinking companies like Apple, for say, have been very scientific about their return to work. They've been slow walking it and they've been doing test groups where they like say, well, let's bring this team back for 2 days a week and see how that goes. Oh, okay. That worked pretty well for this type of job. Let's try that with engineering. Let's try that with our marketing team. Oh, marketing, that didn't work so well.
Didn't work so well. Yeah, and sales, so not at all.
Yeah. So that's something that's one of the core principles that we teach is when you're dealing with complex problems, which this is a perfect example of, it's impossible to simply come up with the answer in a boardroom. You're always going to be wrong. What you need to do is have an attitude of probing, testing, and learning. Let's try this. Let's see how that works. Okay, that worked, so we can continue to do that. But that didn't work, so we need to adjust course. And that is increasingly the way that you have to find your way forward in the world. It doesn't take a lot of time. It's not about not acting. You're acting constantly, but you're acting knowing that you may have to modify your actions. And that's why we think that decision-making should be viewed not as a process, but as a practice, something that you're constantly doing. Every day, you're engaged in refining your decisions and learning from them and modifying them, because that's the only way you can navigate this complex world.
And I think that a lot of it comes down to our original conversation with good versus bad data.
Yeah, a lot of it
does. Did those Goldman Sachs people have the thought in their head, no way in God's green earth am I ever coming back to the office? My team is working remotely. They've been working remotely for 2 years. We've made a boatload of money working remotely. I don't have to wear a suit every day. I don't have to fight Manhattan traffic every day. I don't have to pay $400 a month or $600 a month to park my car.
And I just discovered I had children.
And I have kids. And you know what? I actually like half of them. But if you take a look at it, say, are we asking the right questions? I mean, we work.
That's it right there. You hit something so important. Are we asking the right questions?
Yeah.
You know what? Let me give you a powerful example of that. When I was at Fort Leavenworth, when I was at the Red Teaming School, we did a lot of field trips. And one of them we did was to a team of police officers in Kansas City who were, and I work with them to this day, they're globally recognized experts on community policing because they came up with a novel model of engaging with the community in a non-confrontational way in what had been a really bad part of Kansas City and turned it into a model of the community and police working together in lockstep. So this was back in 2015, and Ferguson had just happened. The riots in Ferguson, Missouri had just happened a year or two before. And these guys were actually brought in by the police department in Ferguson to help them figure out what had gone wrong and how they could avoid another race riot like they had. And what they found was a few years before, just like 8 or 9 years before the riots, there was a new police chief. And he came in, and like a lot of small town police departments, his problem that he realized is that, well, you know, a lot of his cops weren't actually out on the beat. They were in the coffee shop drinking coffee and eating the cliche donuts. So he had a brilliant idea. He asked the wrong question. He said, well, how do I deal with this? He said, I have an idea. I'm going to make a rule that every officer has to have 6 interactions per shift minimum with the community. That makes sense, right? Yeah. You know, what's the problem? Like, the cops aren't actively policing. They're drinking coffee and eating donuts. Well, the solution then is to make them interact. But how does that play out in practice? Well, you're a couple officers in Ferguson, Missouri. It's Saturday afternoon. You got an hour left on your shift. You pulled over 2 people for speeding. You pulled over another guy for running a red light, but there hasn't been any crimes. You got 40 minutes left on your shift. What are you going to do? Oh, look, it's a group of African-American kids playing basketball at the basketball court there. Pull over, throw 3 of them up against the fence and frisk them for drugs or whatever. You got your 3 interventions now. You can go back, you can file your reports, and you can say, I had 6 police interventions. You compound that over years and years and years of that behavior, and you create a community that's at war, where the police are viewed as an occupying power that's at war with the community. And then suddenly something happens that finally someone drops a match in the pool of gasoline that's been building up for 8 or 9 years, and the whole thing explodes. That all happened because somebody asked the wrong question.
And it's teaching people how to ask the right questions. And the problem is when we're dealing with leadership, leadership in the vast majority of things, the Peter principle still exists.
Unfortunately, you are so right, Ben.
We still have a bunch of leaders that are leaders because they've been in their jobs enough years that they've been promoted and promoted and promoted and never trained along the way.
Right.
And the question is, how do we bring about red team thinking if we have a group of leaders that truly are nothing more than managers managing process instead of leaders understanding how to inspire and coach and mentor people?
Well, the answer is that we help those people reclaim the role that they were born with, of being a thinker. So if you think about this, Ben, when you were a little kid, what did you do? You walked around and asked why all the time. Why is the sky blue? Why is the grass green? Why is the dog growling? Why is the dish hot? All these questions. So we're born thinking. We're born challenging. We're born not accepting things at face value, asking tough questions to the point that we irritate our parents. But then something happens along the way where we get into organizations and we find that sometimes these organizations don't welcome our questions, that they don't reward critical thinking, that they reward instead people who shut up and go along to get along. And then, because that's what rewards is rewarded, those people get promoted. And they get promoted to the point where they are now the ones who are enforcing that mode of unquestioning allegiance. But that's not our natural role. And if you give people permission, it's amazing how quickly they can change. So there's a fascinating series of experiments that I talk about in my book. These are the experiments that actually led to the idea of groupthink. They were conducted by a scientist called Ash. I don't remember his first name, not Arthur Ashe. We'll call him Professor Ashe. And these were back in the 1950s. And these are both amazing and terrifying experiments, Ben. So what Ash did is he got a group of 11 drama students at his university together. And he said, right, so you're all going to play students in a scientific experiment on perception. And then he got one person who was the actual subject. And the way the experiments worked was like this. Ash created a series of placards that had three lines on them. And one line was really short, and one line was really long, and one line was about halfway in between the two. And they were all varied a little bit. But the point is, it wasn't even close which line was the short line, which was the middle line, which was the long line. And then he'd show one single line, and he'd say, which of the three lines matches this line? In the control, they said, you would have to be visually impaired or mentally impaired to not be able to guess the correct answer 100% of the time. It was that dramatic a difference, right? But everyone except the subject was an actor, and they went through 10 series. But the way it went is, even though a different person was called on first each time, the subject was never called on first. So in the first set of experiments that Ash did, in every single experiment, if the line was, which was like the medium length line, the actors would say, oh, it's the short line. And then if it was the long line, they'd say it's the short line. If it's the short line, they'd say it's the long line. And they go through this. And a terrifying percentage, I don't remember what it was, but it was well over 50% of subjects, at least once over 10 questions, would give the wrong answer.
Because they didn't want to be seen as being different from the group.
Well, that would be bad enough if that was the case. But then Ash interviewed people afterwards and said, why did you give the wrong answer? And most of those people, over 70% of those people, didn't know they'd given the wrong answer. Because the force of groupthink is so powerful that people start questioning their own reality. And they started thinking, well, maybe it's me. And then once they start thinking that, that starts to influence their perception. So that's terrifying. But here's the thing, that then he did a second set of experiments that should give us hope, Ben. He changed things up. Now, he did the exact same thing, but he had one actor give a different answer, not even the right answer. And as soon as that happened, the percentage of people giving the wrong answer went back to zero. Because he called it the lone dissenting voice gave the subjects permission to think for themselves again. And when they thought for themselves, they could clearly see the truth. So think about that, how that plays out in an organization. If you're in a large organization and you're in a group with 10 managers discussing a problem and nine of them are insisting that something completely idiotic is the case, you're either going to shut up because you don't want to get called out, or even worse, you may agree with them just because you're kind of worn down by the mental pressure of it. But if one person in that group challenges that, odds are you're going to be much more willing to challenge it too. And so we've seen that play out time and time again with companies we've worked with, where people come up to us and say, the tools you taught were great, that's all well and good, but the best thing you did was you gave us permission to say what we've been thinking. And now that we understand that senior leadership wants to hear what we're thinking, it's like the floodgates open up. And that's important, Ben, because one of the things I firmly believe is that the answers that companies need are in those companies themselves. They don't need to hire expensive consultants to come and tell them what to do. I've never been in an organization, a company, a government agency, a military unit, I work with all three all the time, where the answers that they need aren't right there, that there isn't somebody, and usually more than one person, who say, I could tell you what we need to do. Here's the problem right here. Nobody listened to me, but here's the problem. Instead of doing that, though, most organizations pay McKinsey or KPMG or PwC millions and millions of dollars to come and tell them what to do. And it's often wrong.
Or it's just justifying what somebody already thinks. And they said, see, McKinsey told the same thing that we did, so it has to be right.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the questions that I asked a client early on in this process was, you have 320 people in your org chart that have the word strategy in their job title. And this client said, yeah, we do. And I said, so why do you pay McKinsey millions of dollars a year to develop strategy for you? And she looked at me, just, couldn't answer. There's one of two answers. Either you don't trust your own people, which is sad, or you haven't given your people the tools that they need to be able to do their job that they were hired to do. But the solution isn't hiring McKinsey. If you've got 320 people on your payroll that have the word strategy in their title, you should be developing your own strategy.
And you should trust your own people.
Exactly. So that's why we say don't outsource thinking. That's our motto. I've got it on my coffee cup right here.
That's awesome.
Don't outsource thinking.
Bryce, we could talk for another hour. Maybe we'll have to have you back for another round two of this, because I think that there's so much in this whole thought process that it deserves another conversation.
Love to.
But I'm going to ask you two questions. One, what is the best way for people to get in touch with you? Because I think that's really a vital question to ask.
Absolutely. I've got a website, redteamthinking.com. Got a podcast, The Thinking Leader Podcast. Got a TV show, Red Team TV on YouTube. Just go to red-team.tv. And I'm on LinkedIn. You can just go to LinkedIn/Bryce Hoffman, all one word.
Perfect. And here's the last question that I ask everybody. As you leave a meeting and you get in your car and you drive away, what's the one thing you want people to think about you when you're not in the room?
He made me think.
You know what? I have been thinking ever since we started this conversation, you know, 35, 40 minutes ago.
Mission accomplished. I can rest easy tonight, Ben.
Yeah, well, I want to thank you for opening up my brain to different ways of thinking and giving me solace to know that how I've been dealing with my clients and how I've been communicating with my clients is the way that I should be, because you have justified how I've been dealing with my clients for years, and I appreciate that.
That's awesome.
I didn't know the words, but now I do.
Well, thank you for letting me share Red Team Thinking with your audience. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
This has been the Your Living Brand Live Show. I want to thank you for tuning in today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show at yourlivingbrand.live and share your favorite episodes with colleagues and friends. At Your Brand Marketing, we help companies engage, retain, and grow their most valuable assets, their employees. If you're tired of losing great staff and want to retain your best employees, build brand champions and leaders at any level. Contact us for a 30-minute consultation at yourbrandmarketing.com. That's www.yourbrandmarketing.com. Thank you again for listening and sharing. Tune in next week when we ask another guest, what's your story?